the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Senior Program Officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Dr. Jan Agosti, speaks on global health and the Gates Foundation approach to global health inequity. Dr. Jan Agosti is a Senior Program Officer in Infectious Disease Development and Strategic Program Lead for Neglected and Other Infectious Diseases at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Her primary areas of focus are HPV vaccines, diarrhea vaccines, and neglected tropical diseases. Before beginning work for the Gates Foundation, Dr. Agosti directed clinical research at Immunex, which later became Amgen, conducting studies and strategic development of multiple novel biologic compounds for immunologic disorders, infectious diseases, and vaccines. When on the medical school faculty of the University of Washington, Dr. Agosti co-founded the AIDS Vaccine Evaluation Unit, founded the AIDS Clinic at the University of Washington Hospitals and Clinics, and co-directed the AIDS Clinical Trials Unit. These efforts contributed to the first approved antiretroviral treatments. Author of over 50 scientific publications, Dr. Agosti is board certified in internal medicine, infectious disease and allergy, and immunology. She has done field work in developing countries, including India and on the Thai-Cambodia border. Dr. Agosti was raised in Anchorage along with her two sisters and four brothers. She attended Inlet View Elementary School, Turnagain Elementary School, Romig Junior High, and graduated from West High School in 1972. She left Alaska to attend Stanford University, then the University of California, San Diego, the University of Chicago, and the University of Washington. Dr. Agosti eventually settled in Seattle, Washington, where she has lived for the past 28 years with her husband and three children. On Friday, February 27th, she spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on global health and the Gates Foundation approach to global health inequity. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Senior Program Officer in Infectious Disease Development and Strategic Program Lead for Neglected and Other Infectious Diseases at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Dr. Jan Agosti.
Thank you for all the friends and family and all of you for being here today. It's critical to have groups like this that promote global understanding and learning, be a part of our civic life. And as Tam talked about, balancing work-family life is critical, so I really appreciate you making the effort and time to, in your busy lives, to come here today and learn more about the foundation and what we do. The foundation wondered why I was coming to Alaska to present on our work. And I said, well, after the last elections, it's pretty clear that even Alaskans need to know a lot about the globe and what's happening. So I, they agreed completely. And be glad that it's not Bill Gates presenting here today. Bill presented recently at the TED conference, which is a celebrity think tank, more or less. And at that conference, he was publicizing the work in malaria and talking about global health inequity. So to make a point about how we don't have to face the burden of malaria because we don't have it here, he released mosquitoes into the audience. The founder of eBay was sitting in the front row, and he said, that's it, I'm not sitting in the front anymore. And you could tell it wasn't Alaska because the most common comment back at the foundation was, I wonder where you got mosquitoes from. No one could figure out where the mosquitoes came from. So we have a little bit of time today to talk about the foundation and what we do. We've got a core value at the heart of everything that the foundation does. This is a core value of Bill and Melinda and the foundation, and that's that every life, no matter where lived, has equal value. And that guides all of the subsequent work at the foundation. So what we do includes helping harness the advances in health to help those who need them most, and encourage shared responsibility so that not only our communities, but our we see our scope of involvement of us and of the, our governments to reach broadly and globally. The efforts that we undertake include focusing on a limited set of problems where we think we can make a difference. We promote innovation and new scientific research, but the foundation always works in partnership. We don't do it ourselves. We understand that we have to find the best people and work together with them to make the biggest difference. And then we share our results. So of this, we spend $3.6 billion a year in charitable giving this year. And about half of it goes to global health, about a quarter goes to global development, and about a quarter goes to the United States programs. So one of the most important things that we do is to focus on a limited set of issues. This doesn't look very limited when you look at it, but this is a breakdown of some of the key high-priority areas that the foundation focuses on. Now, this also means it says what we don't do. So there are many important efforts. Some of you are involved in them or familiar with them, and we don't take everything on. We do try to distill down what we can, where we can make the most difference. In the United States programs, the foundation focuses on education in particular. The minority rate of graduation from the high school is one area that Bill has highlighted is really a sign of failure of our letting our population reach their full potential. And so they're focused on helping minority kids graduate from high school ready for college. Black male in the United States has a greater chance of being incarcerated than getting a four-year college degree, and we're trying to do what we can to turn that around. The Global Development Program tackles other issues like microfinance or agriculture, improving the nutritional yield of different crops. Water sanitation hygiene is one of the efforts that they've taken on to understand a little bit better. It's hard to turn that one around. But lack of water, sanitation, and hygiene is responsible for so many neonatal deaths. It's the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every 4 hours in the terms of childhood deaths. So now I'm going to talk a little bit more about our global health program, which is the group that I work in. What's the problem in global health? Well, millions of children are dying from preventable and treatable diseases that we can do something about. Just in that fragile newborn period, the first month of life, there are about 4 million children that die every year. What are the biggest killers of children? I ask that to groups all the time, and it was asked to policymakers, senior, knowledgeable public health policymakers. They said AIDS. That's wrong. AIDS is not a big killer of children. They said TB, that's wrong. It's not a big killer of children. The biggest killer of children are pneumonia and diarrhea. And these are things that we have treatments available now that could make a tremendous difference. And small incremental improvements could really make a large inroad into childhood survival. Nutrition, something that we know very easily what to do about, it contributes to over half of these 10 to 11 million deaths each year. So AIDS, TB, and malaria do kill a lot of people overall. They kill 6 million if you include the adults. And then 2 to 3 million children die from diseases that are prevented by standard childhood immunizations, immunizations that have been around for decades. We talk about the 90-10 split in terms of global health inequity. 90% of spending on medical research in the world goes to 10% of the diseases. There's more spent on male pattern balding than there is on all of these global health diseases. And of the 1,400 drugs that were approved by the FDA in the last 20 years, fewer than 20 were specifically for diseases that disproportionately affect the developing world. This was part of the reason that Bill and Melinda decided to focus in on global health is a major part of their philanthropic giving. And Bill and Melinda heard about a disease that many of you have never heard about. It's called rotavirus. It has nothing to do with the Rotary Club. Rotavirus causes diarrhea in children, and it kills about over 500,000 children every year, almost exclusively in the developing countries. It's ubiquitous. All the kids here get it too, but they don't get it as severely, and they get proper treatment. So it's not a killer, but it is a killer in the developing world. And Bill said, how can it be that there's a disease I've never even heard of, nobody's ever heard of, it kills 500,000 children a year, and there's a vaccine to prevent it? What is wrong with this picture? So he took that on as... That was a fundamental part of the initial decision to really work on global health issues and getting these tools out to people that need them most. So we've talked about the inequity. There are a lot of existing tools. For example, the TB treatment could be improved because it takes 6 months. So we want to shorten that down. It's not practical for use in developing countries. And malaria has grown resistant to all the least expensive drugs. So chloroquine, which costs just pennies, now resistance has spread globally. So there's work for us to be done. Sometimes it seems that the problems are just insurmountable. You look at everything that needs to be done, the effort, and you just think that it can't be done. But there are solutions in sight. And what can we do using the tools that we have now, and then what can we do to use scientific advances to take us forward? Well, amongst the simple, cost-effective tools that exist now, nothing but nets. Malaria bed nets were not being used. Fewer than 5% of the kids that could be helped were sleeping under a malaria bed net. Those mosquitoes that spread malaria, the severe forms of malaria, bite at dawn and dusk. If we can get kids under insecticide-treated nets, makes a great difference. And the efforts that have been spread by the sports community and many generous donors in the United States, kids groups, civic groups, have really made a difference in getting the nets out there. It was very simple. It's a $5 net, $5 or $10, and you can really make a difference, save a life. Vaccines that exist now, of course. There's some proven new successes. For example, HIV transmission in Thailand really plummeted with careful prevention messages and really emphasizing use of condoms. That has to be replicated. Newborn health has really improved in countries like Botswana, Sri Lanka, and Honduras. These are not rich countries, but they've worked carefully and together to make a difference. So we've got to spread those advances. And then there's lots of advances in genomics, in DNA research, chemistry, drug development, vaccines that we can apply to global health problems. So there's lots to do, but it needs political will. And it needs resources, government resources. While funding for global health has increased substantially, it still is only a small percentage of the foreign aid funding. So the foundation views as its mission to develop new tools and help deliver the existing global health tools to people that need them most, believing that when health improves, all measures of life do improve. We focus on the solutions for the biggest and most neglected problems and bringing together a diverse set of partners. We look for the best people and work in partnership. Some foundations are operational. They get in there, work on the ground, and do the work. We work in partnership. We're very glad to have our partners take the credit and the glory. We work together with them to achieve the best outcomes. So we're less operational more and more as we've managed to grow over time. We're still relatively small as foundations go, about 250 people. But we primarily are a grant-making organization working together in partnership. And then some groups just give the money and know that the intent is good. The intent is pure, so we're going to just donate. But we also ask and expect results, which makes us different than some foundations. We try to measure what works and what doesn't so that we can leverage the successes and take them even further. So, for example, in accelerating access to existing tools, the HIV program, we have a program in India that's really publicizing how to prevent HIV. And they focused, first of all, on the sex worker community. Bill Gates Sr., Bill's father, went and visited. He said, this is the first time I've been in a whorehouse. And he actually went and was able to talk to the sex workers in the community. It was an important message to destigmatize AIDS in India, where it was still highly stigmatized, people were frightened, and the fear of talking about it meant that you couldn't talk about prevention successfully. And one important step was sitting down and sharing a plate of food with an AIDS patient. So they had a shared plate of food that they both ate off of to show that it wasn't spread that way and that these people were not untouchables and that you could be more open about AIDS by destigmatizing it. It allows people to seek treatment, helps decrease the spread, and helps allow the discussion around prevention messages, helps make sure that people are tested and stop transmitting the virus. And that's one effort. India still has very low rates of AIDS, unlike Africa, where it's some communities, over 50% of the adults are infected. It's still around 2-3% in India. By focusing on the key transmitters, there's a hope to prevent further transmission. Our work in Zambia was very simple. We were going to work on malaria prevention tools, and I'll talk a little bit more. It's really made a difference. We're trying to deliver the vaccines that exist now and advocate and develop new funding mechanisms. Malaria kills about 1 million children every year. We know that we've got the nets. We've got intermittent insecticide treatment that can be used. The problem is that most of the drugs have the resistance. So chloroquine, which costs a few pennies, now has resistance spread almost throughout the world. What we did was work with WHO to try and get them away from recommending what everyone knew was a totally ineffective form of therapy and switch to artemisinin-containing treatments. Artemisinin is a plant-based therapy that even small growers can grow at home, but then is sent to factories and made into a very powerful malaria drug. Artemisinin has been a big advance, but there were still problems around cost because it was several dollars, up to $10 to treat it, because you wanted to use it in combination in order to prevent resistance from emerging. There were also other implications of growing artemisinin on deforestation, water use, conversion of food-growing crops that might improve malnutrition towards a profit crop. So there were issues, and there was a great supply shortage. So one of the things that we did was work with a very clever scientist who had a great idea, and he actually cloned the artemisinin gene and now can be fermented. So it's just like making beer. You can use a fermenter, clone, and produce the artemisinin. And this offers a potential, if we finish the development, to have a very low-cost form of this new and potent malaria therapy. It's still important to use in combination to prevent resistance from emerging so that it does remain potent, but it offers another form of promise. The work in Zambia, working with the insecticide-treated nets, the indoor residual spraying, so this prevents there's no insecticide being released into the environment, but it's just used in a few key locations indoors, and it was a trade-off, we understand. And then just treating periodically with existing simple drugs has made a big difference in malaria in Zambia and a couple of other countries. So those are ways that we worked on many levels to address this global health problem. Childhood vaccines, we've talked about the lack of access, all the children that don't get even their basic childhood vaccines, the kids that are dying from this, and the lack of infrastructure to just deliver the vaccines. What we did was work together with other governments. We started something called the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, GAVI. This is supported by $1.5 billion from the foundation initially, and then additional support later, as well as now other countries in Europe and the U.S. are supporting Gavi, so it now has $7 or $8 billion to just supply vaccines to countries, the simple low-cost childhood vaccines, and help improve the immunization services. Bill says this is probably one of his best investments. We've managed to increase vaccine delivery to the 72 poorest countries in the world, improve coverage levels, and based on what was happening before, they estimate that there's about a 1.7 million lives saved just from the Gavi investment alone. We're hoping to see them introduce other vaccines that we're working on at the foundation, including typhoid vaccine, cholera, Japanese encephalitis vaccine, the HPV vaccine, and rabies vaccine, as amongst others. So rotavirus kills over 500,000 kids each year. Diarrhea is something people are reluctant to talk about, and they'll talk about how AIDS is spread before they'll talk about diarrhea. It's hard to build publicity about it, so you'll find that this important killer is really hidden from the public discourse. There's a new book about diarrhea globally. It's called The Great Unmentionable, which characterizes this. We've got to talk about these problems before we can successfully tackle them. Rotavirus is an important new tool. It's just the new vaccines just have been licensed in the United States in the last couple of years. We're working very hard to get these vaccines out to developing countries. Tiered pricing from the U.S. manufacturers, U.S. and European manufacturers, is a key part of that. For a vaccine that costs $100, they're willing to drop the price for the poorest countries in the world. It's still high. It's still about $16, which is more than we can afford or countries can afford throughout the world. The Gavi countries get it subsidized for 5 to 10 years, but we've still got to get it lower. So one of my projects, which Tam alluded to, is working with manufacturers in India to really drive the price way, way down. The model for this was hepatitis B vaccine, which started out about $100 for the series. You can now get a hepatitis B vaccine dose for 15 cents. And this has been critical for driving its uptake globally, working with the developing country manufacturers. This can be done without sacrificing quality. We do the research on the vaccines. We do the training of the factories, the auditing, making sure that they're done to an international quality standard, and then working to help uptake of the vaccines. So this is a big part of my effort, trying to ensure a safe and secure and affordable vaccine supply for the entire world. Another vaccine that's become available recently prevents cervical cancer. Now, cervical cancer, we've learned, isn't caused entirely by a virus infection. This is called the HPV virus. The new vaccine is 99% effective against the strains in the vaccine. It can only be used preventively, so it has to be given before someone gets this virus infection, and it's acquired very early. As I say, even nice girls and boys get HPV vaccine, and in fact, if you look over time, almost everyone has been exposed to the virus. Most of the time, it goes away on its own. A small percentage of people 10% go to chronic infection, and about 1% go on to precancerous changes. The vaccine can entirely prevent this. It has to be given before the onset of sexual activity, so generally in the early teenage years. Again, it's an expensive vaccine, but the manufacturer is giving it to us at a tiered price. We think it's going to make an important difference in preventing the 500,000 cases each year and the 309,000 mothers that are lost to cervical cancer at a critical time for their well-being in the well-being of their families. Because not every country can afford the vaccine, and because it doesn't work for mothers or women that are already infected, we also worked on screening methods. There's a low-cost screening method, just involves a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of freezing of the cervix if there's a lesion there. Freezing, well, guess where we get our frost from, or our dry ice? Coca-Cola. There's Coca-Cola plants almost throughout the globe, and it only takes about 25 cents of dry ice to treat the precancerous lesion so that the person doesn't go on to develop cancer. It's a very low-cost method. It's not as perfect as pap smears, so what we also did was work with someone with a DNA diagnostic method replacing the pap smear in the United States. We worked with them In the U.S., it's between $50 and $200 for this test. We have it down to $5 by working with Chinese manufacturers and testing it in China and India, and it's working beautifully. So that's another option for women in developing countries to prevent cervical cancer. Neglected tropical diseases include lymphatic filariasis, which you can see in the top slide. It's a worm that wedges itself in the vascular system. It blocks flow of lymph and causes huge swelling and is very disabling. It can be treated with one tablet a year to suppress the swelling, but it does mean that everyone in entire countries needs to be treated every year. The very generous manufacturer in the U.S. has donated the drug to treat this, so it really is only the 50 cents or so to reach the patients with the drug every year. One of the things we're working on is developing a new treatment that actually treats the adult worm that's lodged in the venous, in the vascular system, so that you don't have to retreat every year. You can just treat once and get rid of it and interrupt transmission. So we're trying to develop a new treatment. Until then, we're still working on distributing these tablets everywhere, and we donated about $34 million to that effort last year. In the lower left-hand corner, you can see the consequence of river blindness, another simple parasitic infection, easily treated with once-a-year treatment with the antiparasitics. The implications for children are profound because each blind person is assigned a child that leads them around all day, generally begging. And we saw this throughout in many places in Mali. I saw at least three or four kids that were not able to go to school or do anything and were leading around a blind person. So simple treatments, pennies a treatment, we just have to reach them. These are some of the efforts we're working on now. The lower right-hand corner includes the guinea worm, a very painful worm, 3 feet long. It causes a painful, fiery lesion when it erupts through the skin. The Carter Foundation, former President Jimmy Carter's taken on this effort, and he really took it to heart when he was in Africa, and he thought a woman was walking up to him to present a baby, and all of a sudden he realized she was holding up her breast and out popped a worm, and it's when he was first exposed to guinea worm and said, this is awful, this doesn't even need a treatment. As long as you keep people who have the worm out of the water system, because once the worm hits the water system, it releases thousands of tiny worms that go on to infect others. If you keep them out of the water system, if you make sure someone else brings them their water, you give them some wound care, you can completely interrupt transmission. And so he helped work on making sure the communities filtered their water. At home, they filter it, and as the kids run around, they have a little straw to filter their water. As a longer-range effort, the Carter Foundation has done a lot to improve water in the affected communities. This now has been tremendous progress. Down from 20 or so countries affected by guinea worm, we're down to the last five or so, and some of them are just in certification. We think we're down to two countries, and it's well on track for global eradication, being either the second or third disease to be globally eradicated after smallpox. So those are really due to the efforts of the Carter Foundation and their remarkable commitment over many years. We've come in to support them with a $40 million grant last year to help see this through the final effort. I think altogether we've probably supported this for about $65 million or so. So just a few closing thoughts. We have seen focused investments make some promising inroads on delivering existing tools. We have lots of fun science and development and exciting things happening on research towards new vaccines, new treatments, new diagnostics. But even the resources, the very generous resources of the foundation of Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett, aren't enough to cover the entire program. We need to deliver the cost-effective treatments that we have now more than ever, even in the challenging global economic environment that we're facing, because the longer-term global development, economic development, and improvements in water sanitation hygiene that will take billions and billions are even yet further away. So we view these as a best buy, as a way to make important impact with small investments, focused investments that can really make a tremendous difference. And it's very important for the U.S. to work towards improving its global reputation that's somewhat affected by the recent political developments and what's happened over the last multiple years. We see that investments in global health are an important part of diplomacy. The U.S. has always been very generous, and the U.S. is a generous country, but we're still far behind the U.N. target of a 0.7% donation of our GDP towards foreign aid. We're still at 0.16% last year, and we're hoping that we can match the commitment that's come from admittedly smaller countries, but the Scandinavian countries have met the 0.7 target, the Netherlands has met that target, and there are other countries that are well ahead of us, the UK and Germany, and so we're hoping that we can step up to the plate with focused investments to help improve our stature globally. Thanks.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents, Dr. Jan Agosti of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Recorded in Anchorage on Friday, February 27th, she spoke on global health and the Gates Foundation approach to global health inequity. Following her talk, she responded to questions from the audience. First, she was asked, have there been any efforts by the Gates Foundation to educate people, particularly women, on responsible and healthy family planning? Unless we effectively deal with family planning, won't all of our global health efforts eventually hit a wall? She asked.
Excellent point, Heather, and thank you for raising that issue, because some people look at this and say, well, if we improve all this survival, we're going to end up with overpopulation. You didn't say that, but some people really worry about improving survival, and the best determinant of decreasing family size is when a parent in a family know that their children can survive. And it's well documented that when you improve child survival, you decrease the birth rate and decrease the growing population. Reproductive health is one of the agenda items under our global health priorities. It's one of the 10 or so that you saw there. It is not too politically hot for us to handle it all, and it is an important effort to make sure that families that want family planning have access to that. So our focus has been on meeting the unmet need for family planning to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And there's still huge unmet need. We're focusing in on a few countries where the birth rate is highest, about 5 to 7 children per family, and where there's a large unmet need. And that includes some of our focus on Nigeria, northern Nigeria, on northern India, on Ethiopia. And so you won't see it as a global effort. You'll see it as a focused effort to make the most of the resources that are available. There is a little bit of research going into how we can improve contraceptives, but most of the contraceptives that are available are reasonable to do what needs to be done. In terms of the Buffett Foundation, Susie Buffett has a separate foundation. This is Warren Buffett's daughter. There are other Buffett Foundation, Family Member Foundation efforts that really do work on some of the edgier issues, that more courageous issues around reproductive rights. We primarily focus on access to reproductive, to family planning for people that have an unmet need, that want it but just don't have access to it.
So. Next, another audience member asked, how do you overcome the challenges of working with failed states or states with corrupted governments?
Secondly, he asked if the Gates Foundation offers internships for aspiring scientists.
One example I think of right off the bat is Haiti. What could be more of an example of a failed state? For many years, America supported a corrupt dictatorship in Haiti and subverted and murdered a democratically elected leader of that country, and this was part of our global, now I'm speaking not as a representation of the foundation, and participated in a subversion of the democratic process that we hold so dear for our country. This was part of a regional strategic effort because of Cuba, and has led to a legacy of corruption and bankruptcy of the government and violence in Haiti that they're still struggling to overcome. We have a grant with Notre Dame, as Father Tom Strait, who very courageously works in the most difficult areas of Haiti to work on eradication of lymphatic filariasis. That was the disease that caused the huge swollen limbs and is disabling to people. He's got a drug distribution program to treat the most affected areas, and then for the less affected areas to reach this whole country of 15 million, because he can only distribute the drug now for every 7 or 8 years. He's reached about 1 million people in the worst affected areas. So how do we reach all 15 million? He's worked with salt manufacturers to put a medicine called DEC, which is very safe, and put it into the salt. So that's one way to reach a broad population with a drug that can suppress the parasite that causes this disease. The other thing they put in there is iodine. Iodine is really important to prevent mental disabilities in young children, to promote growth and normal thyroid function. Thyroid deficiencies lead to huge goiters, mental delays, growth delays. They're also putting iodine into the salt, now making it this up till now, Haiti was the only country in the entire Americas that lacked this very fundamental public health intervention. He's doing that through pure dedication and courage. One of their field workers was murdered at a stop. He was taking drugs to the field site. He was stopped at a checkpoint and disappeared. So this really takes, there are people working on the ground in the field that have personal courage, commitment, and that we can only admire in the most profound sense for their dedication to the cause. We're working in Haiti. Now, the Carter Foundation, purely through the reputation of President Carter, engineered a ceasefire between the warring factions so that they could go out and do the guinea worm eradication activities. Quite remarkable, but it shows how important both sides recognized this was. So he was able to engineer that. Right now we're taking advantage of a relatively calm period to try and complete eradication of guinea worm in the Sudan. But it's really a challenge. We've got other efforts, visceral leishmaniasis, that we've got to get into Sudan for. Sudan's one of our toughest areas, and you're correct in linking failed states with public health and health breakdown. Zimbabwe, a perfect example, Robert Mugabe, he wants to declare himself president for life. He's into his 80s. And for those of you in your 80s, great, you're wonderful, but don't make yourselves president for life. Our friends, that's one of the great things about America, and friends from other countries have admired about us. They said after this last transition, that's one of the great things about America, a peaceful transition of leadership. So we've got a problem in Zimbabwe. It may look like it's cholera, but it's really a marker of a failure of the healthcare system, of the water system, of the sanitation system, of the healthcare providers having to flee the country. You can't even get basic electricity. The healthcare facilities are having to close. Relief organizations are providing what care there is, but even they can't get in there necessarily to do what they need to do. So we can work on a vaccine. We can work on relief efforts. We've funded relief efforts in Zimbabwe. But that's going to be a long-term, substantial change in the underpinnings of the state before you can truly make inroads on what manifests as a cholera epidemic spreading to surrounding countries, but really is broader than that. Oh, and the Pat, you asked about internships. Unfortunately, we don't have internships at the foundation. Almost all of our grantees do have internships.
In her talk, Dr. Agosti said a cervical cancer lesion test was about $200 for an American woman and $3 to $5 in developing countries.
Well, yeah, $3 to $5 for that particular test, the DNA test. The DNA test is pretty expensive in the United States and much less. We changed it so it's adaptable to the developing world.
Which begs the question, is the Gates Foundation addressing people struggling in the United States?
I think that's an excellent question, and it points out how we view our role, which is not to take over what we see as the responsibility of governments and health systems to care for their people. If governments start to think that they can depend on nonprofit organizations or bilaterals to assume the responsibility for the health care for their own people, then it relieves them of the need to do long-term systematic delivery of care. And it really is fragmented if we have a lot of small charitable organizations delivering different pieces of the health care. So it's very important to do it. We see the role of the governments to provide health care for their people. And we may step in with a strategic focused investment, either to show a way that works better, to develop a new test that works better, or a new vaccine. But we don't take on true delivery of the health care. It's an important issue, and I agree it needs to be taken care of.
Next, an audience member asked, what is the Gates Foundation relationship with Doctors Without Borders? And as someone who contracted malaria, he asked if the Gates Foundation was doing any work using DDT in small cities and towns where the environmental problem is not as severe for malaria control.
Two excellent questions. Doctors Without Borders, an excellent relief organization. We work with them. We support a little bit of the field trials that they're doing on new treatments for sleeping sickness. The current treatment kills about 1 out of 10 people that take it. It's not a treatment you want to take, but the disease kills everybody. Sleeping sickness is uniformly fatal. It just wasn't a workable form of treatment, and so we've worked with them to develop a short course that gets patients out of the hospital. The intravenous treatment needed 4 times a day IVs was totally impractical for rural impoverished hospitals. So now it's down to a much shorter course and easier treatment. So we worked together with Médecins Sans Frontières. We supported part of their research in that area, or Doctors Without Borders. That's Médecins Sans Frontières, the other name they go by. We've also supported their relief efforts in different countries, and they're very much commended for emergency relief. Emergency relief isn't a big part of what we do, but we do try to step up to the plate, and we gave $1 million to relief efforts in Zimbabwe for the cholera outbreak. Médecins Sans Frontières is there on the forefront, on the ground, administering fluids and helping take care of patients. And their ability to, and their willingness to go into difficult situations is one of the things that really commends that organization. DDT has a emotional history in the environmental movement, and yet it turns out is one of the safest and best insecticides out there. We don't advocate, and the foundation does not advocate, use of DDT the way it was used in the 60s on broad environmental spraying over trees, over forests, over fields, from planes, the way it was used when we were kids and we were all sprayed with DDT. It's a reasonably safe for humans insecticide. But we're not going back to those days, and we're not advocating going back to that those days, because we know it did have very substantial accumulation in the feeding, in the biosystems, so that it was concentrated in eggs of birds and had negative long-term impact. But we do know that it's a very valuable tool for indoor residual spraying in a very focused, limited way. It can be used safely where it doesn't impact the environment, where it doesn't get out into the environment. And when you compare that, the very minimal downside of use of DDT with the very real life-threatening malaria that's killing children in villages, it just is a trade-off that we have to think seriously about and seriously consider using DDT, because we can't let children die because there might be a small theoretical risk to use of it in this focal application. So it's one of the more difficult trade-offs that we have to think very carefully about. We are working on more focused ways of improving malaria control, including you can release sterile mosquitoes, which interrupt replication mosquitoes. Someone even has an idea of using a laser to kill mosquitoes, and kind of an intriguing concept. It's one of those thoughts, but it will make inroads in those million children that die each year from malaria.
Lastly, Tim Thomas from the CDC asked about the Gates Foundation's involvement on the political end. Aside from pouring money into countries, how are you working with governments to ensure that the money is going to be sustained? Second, he asked about safe water. Where is the push for governments to improve their water systems? He asked.
Great, thanks. Some of you may not know that Alaska has a lot of important legacy through the CDC research that's been done in Alaska, sometimes in the native populations. Many of the basic virus, the basic vaccines were tested in Alaska through the CDC. And so those, when I read my medical literature, I always see a lot of papers coming out of the CDC in Alaska. It's a very long legacy of important global health leaders that have passed through here. The questions are excellent. Sustainability of the projects so that they last beyond the immediate time of the project is one of our measures of success. So we work with governments. For example, right now I'm starting a project in Bangladesh. So I met with the government of Bangladesh as the very first step. And we secured a commitment from them to use their vaccine delivery system to deliver the cholera vaccine to one of the urban slums and then help us measure impact. This is the first step in getting a commitment from them to actually introduce it in the country. It's not the whole way there, and countries are really challenged to meet even these decreased low-cost interventions. It's still very expensive because they're working with $1, $2, $3 a person is their healthcare budget. So we do groom relationships with the heads of state. I met with the Vice Minister of Health of Peru just yesterday on HPV vaccine. They're one of our leaders, and the women of Peru are really active in trying to get this cervical cancer prevention vaccine and screening out to the women of Peru. So we do work with governments on all levels, but we have to time it right because the governments change so often, and the first thing that happens is they change the Minister of Health. We're lucky if they get someone that's very knowledgeable about issues, but if they don't, we work with them to teach them. And we found out that ministers of health that we sat down with in Africa to talk about rotavirus had never heard of rotavirus. How can this be killing so many children? And they've just put someone in the head of Ministry of Health that's never heard of it. And I don't know, maybe we should see if our leaders know about it too, but the first step is educating them, and we go in with evidence from their country. Okay, here's the burden of the diseases in your country. Here's what it's going to cost to deliver the vaccine. It's only cost this much. We can do it. We've shown that the operational costs are such. Here's your cost effectiveness. You're going to save money. You're going to save lives if you introduce it. And so we start out with a white paper and we educate them. And that's the exact place that we're at right now with this vaccine that's just coming on board in the next couple months. Education, outreach, you can't do it too early because you've just finished educating someone that's not even there, but you do want to educate the key decision makers in each country. And then your other question was on water, sanitation, and hygiene. Our global development group has the unenviable job of taking on that monumental task. Different estimates are that it'll take $200 billion to fix the global water, sanitation, hygiene issue. Some say more than that. It is a critical piece of the long-range impact on health. The United States used to have typhoid. It used to have cholera. It used to have all these diarrheal diseases in the 1880s in Pittsburgh and New York. We had malaria, and it was gradually improvements in health, public health, and development that got rid of them for us. These countries are 100 years behind, and we're trying to shorten that. But we've got to, one way we're dealing with the water issue is a point-of-use water purification, so that if you can't treat the entire country's water, and in fact most of that water is going to the fields anyway to irrigate, can we just get households to treat their own water? So CDC has a very valuable program to educate households to treat their own personal drinking water. And that's part of our cholera project in Bangladesh, working with the CDC representative there to not just give the cholera vaccine, but also put it in context of promoting safe hand washing and point-of-use water purification for the household. So at least the mother, the family, can protect their children and themselves, even if we can't reach the entire community at this point. Global security on water is an issue. Corporations buying water rights. Now, again, I'm speaking not as a representative of the foundation, but because we're not allowed to lobby. But you have to be keep an eye on rights for water access and understand that this is a public good, and we need to maintain public access to water. Corporations buying rights to water in developing countries is a worrisome trend. For their part, countries are starting, companies, multinational corporations, just recently have started to calculate their water footprint, just like they calculate their carbon footprint. And then they do trade-offs. So they say, well, if we use water here, we're going to offset it by developing more water in another area. So just like you'd track and mitigate your carbon footprint impact, they're starting to think about their water imprint, their water footprint, and how they might mitigate the impact of that. Still worrisome, though, because if you look at trends globally, there seems to be some worrisome trends in water security.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Jan Agosti, Senior Program Officer in Infectious Disease Development and Strategic Program Lead for Neglected and Other Infectious Diseases at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk on global health and the Gates Foundation approach to global health inequity. Recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, February 27, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.
you.